States was fighting. This explains why the main thrust of U.S. violence was directed to the South, where napalm, B-52 bombing raids, chemical warfare, the institutionalized killings of civilians, and a scorched earth policy were used to destroy the base of the popular movement. We also noted earlier that this ferocious U.S. assault on the South, which contradicted the claim that we were protecting South Vietnamese, remains invisible in the U.S. media. Another important theme in the mainstream media for many years has been the notion that the United States was the victim in the Vietnam War, the Vietnamese the cruel villains. This remarkable inversion of reality has been accomplished by two processes. First, by a massive suppression of evidence on the consequences of the war for the Vietnamese, and second, by demonizing the victims, based in large measure on the national beatification of POWs, prisoners of war, and the myth of POWs as martyrs still being tortured by Vietnam. The only Vietnamese allowed modest attention in the media have been those mobilized to fight the U.S. war and who were let down. The vast numbers killed or damaged by the U.S. assault have been treated as unworthy victims. The overwhelming preoccupation of officials, journalists, pundits, and intellectuals with media outreach has been on U.S. victims and the effects of the war on this country. Robert McNamara's widely publicized book, supposedly a mea culpa and moral tract, is notable for the fact that his notion of the war's high costs and the error and guilt he feels extend only to U.S. lives and the effects of the war on the political unity of our society. He offers neither regrets, moral reflections, nor apologies for his country having invaded, mercilessly bombed, ravaged the land, and killed and wounded millions of innocent people in a small, distant peasant society in pursuit of its own political ends. In a remarkable cultural process also, the victims have been turned into the villains. As we describe in Chapter 5, in an attempting to prolong the war, President Richard Nixon seized on the question of the adequacy of Vietnamese accounting for our military personnel who were captured, POWs, and those missing in action, MIAs. He succeeded in keeping the war going, and some 16,000 more U.S. soldiers and untold numbers of Vietnamese died in the further fighting in the purported interest of missing POWs. But although there has never been any credible evidence that a single POW was hidden by the North Vietnamese, this claim became an article of faith and cult that dominated U.S. policy toward Vietnam for many years. The myth also became the basis of popular culture accounts in movies such as The Deer Hunter, Uncommon Valor, POW, The Escape, and Missing in Action, in which Rambo-like heroes slaughter evil Vietnamese as they save our betrayed and tormented POWs. These movies turned history on its head. As Vietnam War historian H. Bruce Franklin points out, America's vision of the war was being transformed. The actual photographs and TV footage of massacred villagers, napalmed children, Vietnamese prisoners being tortured and murdered, wounded GIs screaming in agony, and body bags being loaded by the dozen for shipment back home were being replaced by simulated images of American POWs in the savage hands of Asian communists. The powerful cultural myth of abused POWs as the central feature of the Vietnam War not only allowed the war to be extended, it helped justify the U.S. failure to aid its victim in accord with end-of-war promises, and it provided the basis for an 18-year economic war against the victim country. It also functioned as a potent agent of militarization and force, weakening the Vietnam syndrome. In his recent book, Vietnam and Other American Fantasies, H. Bruce Franklin, who had previously exposed the fallacies and cult qualities of the POW-MIA myth, addressed this issue once again, as well as other fantasies, such as the claim that the anti-war activists often spit at returning veterans. Franklin's book was reviewed in the Los Angeles Times, but was otherwise only twice mentioned in passing in the U.S. mainstream press. On the other hand, a book by Michael Lind, Vietnam, The Necessary War, which explains that the war was justifiable because communism was on the march, U.S. credibility was at stake, and the Vietnamese communists were cruel and ruthless, demonstrated in part by their refusal to surrender and consequent responsibility for those killed by U.S. bombs, was treated differently. It received 44 reviews and was mentioned 27 other times in the mainstream media, and Lind was given op-ed space in both the New York Times and the Washington Post, among other opportunities. In his review of Lind's book, Vietnam War historian Lloyd Gardner noted that any U.S. credibility problem that arose in connection with the Vietnam War was a creation of the war managers themselves and flowed from their own decisions. And Gardner also comments, after analyzing a series of Lind arguments in defense of the war, that the evidence simply washes away his positions like a sandcastle on the beach. But Lind was saying what the elite once said, and Franklin was not, so that mainstream media treatment followed accordingly. Laos. Laos's Plain of Jars was subjected to some of the heaviest bombings of civilian targets in history, especially after 1968, when Washington was compelled under domestic pressure to enter negotiations with North Vietnam and had to terminate its bombing there. It turned to Laos, although that small peasant country was a marginal factor in the wars. But Nixon and Kissinger could hardly leave U.S. bombers inactive. Overall, some 2 million tons of bombs were dropped on Laos. These raids wiped out 353 villages and killed thousands of civilians, and they continue to kill now, as the plain was saturated with hundreds of millions of bombies, tiny anti-personnel weapons specifically designed to kill and maim. With their 20-30% failure to explode rate, they remained as potential killers, and their casualty rate is still high, estimates running from hundreds to 20,000 or more per year, half of them deaths and half of the victims children. There have been efforts to deal with this humanitarian catastrophe. The British-based Mines Advisory Group, MAG or MAG, has been trying to remove the lethal objects, but the British press reports that the United States is conspicuously missing from the handful of Western organizations that have followed MAG, though it has finally agreed to train some Laotian civilians. The British press also reports, with some annoyance, that the United States has refused to provide MAG specialists with render harmless procedures, still treated as a state secret for weapons 3 decades old. The U.S. mainstream media have treated in very low-key the continuing human toll suffered in Laos and have maintained almost complete silence concerning the U.S. non-cooperativeness in attempts to alleviate a crisis dating back to the secret war against Laos, which again was secret only by tacit propaganda service of the mainstream media. Cambodia. Important changes have occurred in Cambodia since 1988, including Vietnam's withdrawal from that country, elections held under UN auspices, and the death of Pol Pot. We noted in Chapter 7 that after the Vietnamese had ousted Pol Pot in December 1978, although the United States and its allies had denounced Pol Pot as another Hitler committing genocide, they quickly became his supporter, allowing him to retain Cambodia's UN seat and otherwise aiding and protecting him in his Thailand refuge. Vietnam was severely punished by harsh sanctions and by U.S. support for a Chinese invasion to teach Vietnam a lesson for having terminated Pol Pot's atrocities. President Carter's national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, stated in 1979 that, "I encouraged the Chinese to support Pol Pot. I encouraged the Thai to help DK, Democratic Kampuchea, Pol Pot's forces. Pol Pot was an abomination. We could never support him, but China could." In the late 1980s and early 1990s, as the Vietnamese sought to end their isolation by exiting from Cambodia, but insisted as a condition for withdrawal that Pol Pot and his Khmer Rouge be excluded from returning to power, the United States objected and insisted, with eventual success, that the Khmer Rouge be included as a contestant party in the post-occupation settlement. What dominated U.S. policy and led to its support of Pol Pot was the classic rule that the enemy of my enemy, Vietnam, is my friend, and perhaps also the new tilt toward China, also hostile toward Vietnam. The support of Pol Pot was awkward, given the prior denunciations of his policies, but the mainstream media handled it with aplomb, and the U.S. public was almost surely completely unaware that the United States had become his ally and supporter. The explicit statement of support by Brzezinski quoted before was never mentioned in the New York Times, the Washington Post, or Newsweek. It was quoted once in both the Los Angeles Times and Time. However, in the late 1990s, after Vietnam had left Cambodia and U.S. officials' anti-Vietnam passions had subsided, and Pol Pot was no longer a useful instrument of anti-Vietnam policy, U.S. officials and pundits rediscovered Pol Pot's and the Khmer Rouge's villainy and candidacy for war crimes trials. The media handled the previous tilt toward Pol Pot mainly by evasion, essentially blacking out the years 1979 to 95, or vaguely intimating that the U.S. had supported him for reasons of realpolitik, but avoiding both details on the nature and magnitude of support, as well as any reflections on the morality of backing another Hitler. The New York Times summary of Pol Pot's rise and fall, April 17, 1998, lists for 1979 to 1990, Pol Pot and Khmer Rouge are given refuge at Thai border where they fight back against the Vietnamese. Given refuge is misleading. They were given economic and military aid and political support by the United States and its allies. The Times' main reporter on Cambodia in early 1998, Seth Maidans, repeatedly blacked out mention of U.S. support, referring to the decade-long civil war that followed Pol Pot's ouster, April 13th, and a 19-year guerrilla insurgency in the jungles of western and northern Cambodia, April 17th. The Boston Globe, New York Times, Washington Post, and Los Angeles Times, editorializing on the death of Pol Pot on April 17, 1998, were uniformly indignant over his crimes and regretful at his escape from justice, but all avoided mentioning the long U.S. support of the criminal, as well as the U.S. contribution to the first phase of a decade of genocide. The Washington Post blacked out the inconvenient 15-year period of support of Pol Pot with this summary: after the nightmare of Khmer Rouge rule and genocide, the United States and its allies pumped millions of dollars into Cambodia to help rebuild and to hold elections. It is enlightening to compare the media's treatment of Pol Pot and Indonesian leader Suharto, who was also in the news in 1998, as Indonesia suffered a financial crisis that, along with popular resistance to the dictatorship, eventually led to his ouster. Pol Pot was described in the editorials and news columns of April 1998 as crazed, a killer, war criminal, mass murderer, blood-soaked, and as having engineered a reign of terror and genocide. But in 1998 and 1999, and in earlier years as well, while Suharto was occasionally referred to as a dictator and running an authoritarian regime, he was never a killer or mass murderer or one responsible for genocide. The terminological double standard is maintained reliably throughout the mainstream media. Less obvious, but equally interesting, is the difference in willingness to identify the responsible parties for the killings of Pol Pot and Suharto. In the case of Pol Pot, there is no uncertainty or complexity. Editorials and news articles uniformly make him and the Khmer Rouge leadership clearly and unambiguously responsible for all deaths in Cambodia during the period 1975 to 78. He was the man who slaughtered 2 million, USA Today, the executioner, Boston Globe, who presided over the deaths of his victims, Washington Post, the man who drove Cambodia to ruin, New York Times. But in Suharto's case, we move to an ambiguous responsibility, which means none at all. In the New York Times, for example, a 1965 coup led to the massacre of hundreds of thousands of supported communists, editorial August 23, 1996. Where we have no agent doing the killing. Or a wave of violence that took up to 500,000 lives and led Suharto to seize power from Sukarno in a military coup. Seth Maidens, August 7, 1996, where the massacre not only has no agent, but is falsely situated before the takeover of power by Suharto. In a later piece, Maidens states that more than 500,000 Indonesians are estimated to have died in a purge of leftists in 1965, the year Mr. Suharto came to power, April 8, 1997. Note the passive voice, never used in connection with Pol Pot, the word purge instead of slaughter or massacre, and the continued failure to identify the agent. In the case of East Timor, also, the Times is uncertain about the source of the killing. This is one of the world's sadder places, where 100,000 to 200,000 people died from 1974 in a brutal civil war and the consequent invasion through combat, execution, disease, and starvation. Stephen Erlanger, October 21, 1990. In addition to the lack of a clear agent, this sentence seriously misrepresents the facts. The civil war was short and left small numbers of dead, and the invasion was not consequent to a brutal civil war, except in Indonesian propaganda. Another important difference in the treatment of the worthy victims of Pol Pot and the unworthy victims of Suharto is in the willingness to explain away the killings. With Pol Pot, as we describe in Chapter 7, the background of the first phase of the genocide was completely blacked out by the mainstream account. There is no qualification to Pol Pot's responsibility as a killer because his forces had undergone terrible damage and sought vengeance for the crimes they had suffered. Nor are any deaths in Pol Pot's years of rule to be explained by the starvation and disease already pervasive in April 1975. No, the only mentionable background is his Paris training and communist fanaticism. But with Suharto, we encounter a whole new world of contextualized apologetics. For many years, the main protective formula was that the 1965-66 killings were a result of a failed coup, which touched off a wave of violence or followed an onslaught from the left. This formula, invoked repeatedly, suggests that the mass killings were provoked and thus may be justified by a prior onslaught. The writers never explain why a failed coup could possibly justify a large-scale slaughter, but the hint is left hanging. In more recent years, usually in connection with the explanation and rationalization of the continuation of a dictatorship, the media regularly juxtaposed political repression with stability and growth. The signs of his success are everywhere. Although Suharto has brought these gains by maintaining a tight grip on power and suppressing public criticism and political opposition, these statements from the New York Times offer a kind of context that the paper never gives to Castro, let alone a Pol Pot, and it shows an apologetic that runs deep. This apologetic extends to the Suharto invasion and occupation of East Timor. For years, New York Times reporters have claimed that Indonesia invaded in the midst of a civil war, when in fact that civil war was over well before the invasion. The paper's news coverage of East Timor actually fell to zero as the Indonesian attacks and killings in East Timor reached a deadly peak in 1977-78, a slaughter that elsewhere would be called genocidal. And although Indonesia occupied East Timor in violation of standing UN rulings till its induced exit in 1999, the paper's reporters repeatedly referred to East Timor as a disputed province and East Timorese resistance as separatist, thereby internalizing and explicitly legitimizing the aggression and occupation. The bias and gentle treatment of Suharto and the Indonesian government in the media is once again correlated with U.S. policy support that dates back to the military coup and slaughters of 1965. These were greeted with enthusiasm by U.S. officials. Then Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara referred to the events as one of the dividends of U.S. support for the Indonesian military, and the boiling bloodbath, Time, and staggering mass slaughter, New York Times, were also seen in the media as a gleam of light, James Reston in the New York Times. U.S. military and economic aid and diplomatic protection continued throughout the years of the Suharto dictatorship, and the media's finding him a good genocidist followed accordingly. New York Times reporter David Sanger differentiated Suharto and post-1990 Saddam Hussein. Before 1990, he was a U.S. ally, saying, "Mr. Suharto is not hoarding anthrax or threatening to invade Australia." That is, Suharto's invasion, mass killing, and long illegal occupation of East Timor is given zero weight, and his slaughter of somewhere between 500,000 and 2 million people within Indonesia some years back is also not mentioned. This tells us all we need to know about how good and bad genocidists fare in the Western propaganda system. Further applications. In his book Golden Rule, political scientist Thomas Ferguson argues that where the major investors in political parties and elections agree on an issue, the parties will not compete on that issue, no matter how strongly the public might want an alternative. He contends that for ordinary voters to influence electoral choices, they would have to have strong channels that directly facilitate mass deliberation and expression. These would include unions and other intermediate organizations that might, through their collective power, cause the interests of ordinary voters to be given greater weight in the political system. The propaganda model, and the institutional arrangements that it reflects, suggests that the same forces that preclude competition among the parties on issues on which the major investors agree will also dominate media choices and rule out mass deliberation and expression on those issues. For example, polls regularly indicate that, except in periods of war and intense war propaganda, the public wants a smaller defense budget and favors a spending shift from defense to education and other civil functions. But because the major investors agree that a large defense budget is desirable, the two dominant parties compete only on whether the one or the other is stinting on military expenditures, with both promising to enlarge it, as both George W. Bush and Al Gore did in the presidential election campaign of 2000. And the mainstream media do the same thing, limiting debate to the terms defined by the two parties and excluding deliberation and expression of the position that large cuts are desirable. The alternative presidential candidate, Ralph Nader, called for such cuts, but the media denied him a voice on the issues, some of them explicitly defending his exclusion from the presidential debates on the grounds that the options afforded by the two parties sufficed. The U.S. corporate community has favored an immense defense budget, currently more than five times the size of that of a steadily weakening Russia, the second biggest spender, because of the great benefits its members derive from military spending. These include weapons and other contracting business, direct and indirect subsidies in research, and the role played by military power in supporting the global economic expansion in which many U.S. transnational corporations are active participants and beneficiaries. Business also benefits from the market opening actions of trade agreements and from the supportive operations of the WTO, the World Bank, and the IMF. But these trade agreements and the activities of the international financial institutions have generated controversy and political struggle because while their benefits to business are clear, their costs are borne heavily by workers forced to compete in a global job market. Furthermore, globalization and trade agreements strengthen the political as well as the economic power of the corporate community, in part because they shift decision-making authority from democratic polities to bankers and technocrats, who more reliably serve the transnational corporate interest. Here also, as the case of defense versus civilian-oriented budgets, polls show a sharp dichotomy between corporate and public preferences, with the latter generally hostile to the agreements and institutional arrangements favored by business. The propaganda model fits well the media's treatment of this range of issues. Consider, for example, their coverage of the passage of the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, and the subsequent Mexican financial crisis and meltdown of 1994-95. Polls taken before its enactment consistently showed substantial majorities opposed to NAFTA and later to the bailout of investors in Mexican securities, but the elite in favor. Media editorials, news coverage, and selection of experts in opinion columns were heavily skewed toward the elite preference. Their judgment was that the benefits of NAFTA were obvious, were agreed to by all qualified authorities, and that only demagogues and special interests were opposed. The special interests, who might be the losers, included women, minorities, and a majority of the workforce. The media dealt with the awkward fact that polls showed steady majority opposition to the agreement mainly by ignoring it, but occasionally they suggested that the public was uninformed and didn't recognize its own true interests. The effort of labor to influence the outcome of the NAFTA debates was sharply attacked in both the New York Times and the Washington Post, with no comparable criticism of corporate or government, U.S. and Mexican, lobbying and propaganda. And while labor was attacked for its alleged position on these issues, the press refused to allow the actual position to be expressed. In December 1994, only 11 months after NAFTA went into effect, Mexico suffered a major financial crisis, including a massive flight of capital, a devaluation of the currency, and a subsequent bailout by the IMF that required Mexico to carry out painful deflationary measures. Despite the fact that the meltdown occurred within a year of the introduction of NAFTA, which the media had portrayed as ushering in a prospective golden age of economic advance, they were unanimous that NAFTA was not to blame. And in virtual lockstep, they supported the Mexican investor bailout. despite poll reports of general public opposition in the United States. Experts and media pundits and editorialists repeatedly explained that one great merit of NAFTA was that it had locked Mexico in so that it couldn't alter its overall policy direction or resort to controls to protect itself from severe deflation and unemployment. They were oblivious to the profoundly undemocratic nature of this lock-in, made more questionable by the fact that it had been negotiated by a Mexican government that ruled as a result of electoral fraud. More recently, when the growing global opposition to the policies of the WTO, the IMF, and the World Bank led to mass protests at the WTO conference in Seattle in November and December 1999, and then at the annual meeting of the IMF and the World Bank in Washington, D.C. in April 2000, media coverage of these events was derisive and hostile to the protesters and almost uniformly failed to deal with the substantive issues that drove the protests. The media portrayed the Seattle protesters as all-purpose agitators, U.S. News and World Report, terminally aggrieved, Philadelphia Inquirer, simply against world trade, ABC News, and making much ado about nothing, CNN. But the basis of the protesters' grievances were almost entirely unexplored. Similarly, in the case of the Washington, D.C. protests, the media repeatedly reported on activists' attire, looks, body odors, faddism, and claimed a lack of anything that can coherently be called a cause. Michael Kelly, journalist, Washington Post. And they continued their refusal to address issues. There were many informed protesters with coherent agendas at Seattle and Washington, including reputable economists, social theorists, and veteran organizers from around the world. But the media did not seek them out, preferring to stereotype anti-globalization activists as ignorant troublemakers. On op-ed pages, there was a major imbalance hostile to the protesters. TV bias was at least as great, and often misleading on the facts. In his November 29, 1999 backgrounder on the WTO, Dan Rather explained that the organization had ruled on many environmental issues, implying that those rulings were protective of the environment, when in fact they generally privileged trade rights over environmental needs. Another notable feature of media reporting on both the Seattle and Washington, D.C. protests, and a throwback to their biased treatment of the protests of the Vietnam War era, 1965 to 75, was their exaggeration of protester violence, their downplaying of police provocations and violence, and their complacence at illegal police tactics designed to limit all protester actions, peaceable or otherwise. Although the Seattle police resorted to force and used chemical agents against many nonviolent protesters well before a handful of individuals began breaking windows, both then and later, the media reversed this chronology, stating that the police violence was a response to protester violence. In fact, the vandals were largely ignored by the police, while peaceful protesters were targeted for beatings, tear gas, torture with pepper spray, and arrest. One New York Times article went so far as to claim that the Seattle protesters had thrown excrement, rocks, and Molotov cocktails at delegates and police officers. The Times later issued a correction acknowledging that these claims were false. Dan Rather, who had falsely alleged that the protesters had brought on today's crackdown at Seattle, later suggested that the Washington protesters were possibly hoping for a replay of last year's violence in Seattle, setting this off against those charged with keeping the peace who have other ideas. In their 87-page report, Out of Control, Seattle's Flawed Response to Protests Against the World Trade Organization, the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, stated that demonstrators in Seattle were overwhelmingly peaceful, not so the police. The response of the Seattle police to the protests was characterized by draconian violations of civil liberties, including widespread use of chemical weapons, rubber bullets, and clubs against peaceful protesters and bystanders alike. But NBC, ABC, CBS, CNN, and the New York Times and Washington Post all ignored the release of the ACLU's findings, which ran counter to their own uniformly pro-police and anti-protester line. The media's reversal of chronology and inflation of the threat of activist violence and their low-key treatment of numerous illegal police actions designed to instill fear in those wanting to protest peaceably provided the enabling ground for both police violence and serious restrictions on free speech. These increased in scope and sophistication between Seattle and Washington, and were then applied to squelch protest at the Republican and Democratic conventions in Philadelphia and Los Angeles in July and August 2000. The corporate media's hostility to the goals of the protests, closely aligned with that of the rest of the corporate establishment, caused their devotion to the First Amendment to flag in a way it never has when their own rights and privileges have been at stake. As is suggested by the media's treatment of NAFTA and of labor's right to participate in its debates, as well as the media coverage of Watergate, COINTELPRO, and major events in the earlier history of labor management conflict, the Haymarket Affair, the Homestead Strike, the post-World War I Red Scare, the propaganda model applies to domestic as well as foreign policy issues. Labor has been under renewed siege in the United States for the past several decades, its condition adversely affected by the deflationary policies of the early 1980s, corporate downsizing, globalization, a vigorous business campaign to defeat unions, and government support of or indifference to the damage being inflicted on unions and workers. There was a major drop in union membership from the beginning of the Reagan era, with union density falling from 25% in 1980 to 14.5% in 1996, and only 10.2% in the private sector. This reflected weakened labor bargaining power and was accompanied by significant concessions in wages and benefits, more onerous working conditions, and greater worker insecurity. President Reagan's firing of 11,000 striking air controllers in 1981 put the government seal of approval on strike breaking and a new era of industrial relations opened. But you would hardly know this from reading or listening to the mainstream media. An exceptional 1994 Business Week article noted that, over the past dozen years, U.S. industry has conducted one of the most successful union wars ever, helped by illegally firing thousands of workers for exercising their right to organize, with unlawful firings occurring in one-third of all representation elections in the late 80s. But this successful war was carried out quietly with media cooperation. The decertification of unions, use of replacement workers, and long debilitating strikes like that involving Caterpillar were treated in a very low-key manner. In a notable illustration of the applicability of the propaganda model, the 9-month-long Pittston miners' strike that began in April 1989 was accorded much less attention and less friendly treatment than the Soviet miners' strikes of the summer of that same year. From 1977 through 1999, while the incomes of the top 1% of households grew by 84.8% and the top 10% by 44.6%, the bottom 60% lost ground, and the income of the lowest 20% fell by 12.5%. Real hourly earnings of production and non-supervisory employees, the 80% of the workforce that holds working-class jobs, fell by 4.8% between 1973 and 1999. This, along with the adverse trend of social indicators in the same period, suggests that the welfare of the majority declined in this era of high employment, a new economy, and a spectacular upswing in the stock market. In its euphoria phase, which ended abruptly with the collapse of the dot-com market in 1999 and 2000, the mainstream media hardly noticed that only a minority had been the beneficiaries. They briefly discovered this issue only under the impetus of Pat Buchanan's right-wing populist outcries during the 1996 presidential election campaign. In the 2000 electoral campaign, once again, the two major party candidates said nothing about the failure of the majority to be lifted in the supposed rising tide that would benefit everybody. Only Ralph Nader and other marginalized candidates did, and as noted, the dominant media found that the agenda of the major parties was all that they could ask for. Another striking application of the propaganda model can be seen in the media's treatment of the chemical industry and its regulation. Because of the industry's power, as well as the media's receptivity to the demands of the business community, the media have normalized a system described by Rachel Carson in Silent Spring as deliberately poisoning us, then policing the results. Industry is permitted to produce and sell chemicals, and during the 1990s, bioengineered foods, without independent and prior proof of safety. And the policing by the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, has been badly compromised by underfunding and political limits on both law enforcement and testing. A major National Research Council study of 1984 found that there was no health hazard data available for 78% of the chemicals in commerce. And an Environmental Defense Fund update found little change had occurred a dozen years later. The federal government's National Toxicology Program tests about 10 to 20 chemicals a year for carcinogenicity, but not for the numerous other possible adverse effects of chemicals. But meanwhile, 500 to 1,000 new chemicals enter commerce annually, so our knowledge base steadily declines. This system works well for industry, however, as it wants to sell without interference and leaving virtually all of the research and testing for safety in its hands, with its members to decide when the results are worthy of transmission to the EPA, is a classic fox guarding the chickens arrangement. The system has worked poorly for the public, and its inadequacy has been reinforced by the industry's power to influence, sometimes even capture, the EPA. Nevertheless, the industry often contends that the safety of chemicals is assured by EPA or FDA regulation, which industry does its best to keep weak and which, as noted, has failed to deal in any way with the great majority of chemicals in the market. With the media's help, the chemical industry has also gained wide acceptance of its view that chemicals should be evaluated individually on the basis of an analysis of their risks to individuals and individual tolerances. But it is very hard to measure such risks and tolerances for humans. Controlled experiments are not possible. Damage may show up only after many years. The forms of damage are hard to know in advance. Chemicals may interact with others in the environment. They may be bioaccumulative, and the breakdown products of chemicals may have their own dangers. Furthermore, if thousands of chemicals enter the environment, many long-lasting, bioaccumulative, and interacting with other chemicals, a public policy that ignores their additive and interactive effects on people and the environment is deeply flawed and irresponsible. Policy based on the precautionary principle, bitterly opposed by the chemical industry with the support of the U.S. government, would not allow chemicals to enter the environment without full testing, would prohibit the use of chemicals that accumulate in human tissues and whose breakdown products are threatening or unknown, and would compel the use of non-threatening alternatives for untested and known to be risky chemicals where such alternatives can be found or developed at reasonable cost. In successfully avoiding application of the precautionary principle, industry spokespersons have argued that the existing system is based on sound science. But science does not tell us that industry has any right to put chemicals into the environment that have any risk at all, let alone telling us what risks are acceptable. These are political decisions. Furthermore, if the chemicals in the environment have not been tested for all the variables that are relevant to social choices, such as their long-term effects on immune systems and reproduction, as well as any cancer threat and the effects of their breakdown products on the environment, and none of them have been so tested, the political, not scientific, basis of sound science is evident. The chemical industry has produced and long denied any harm from innumerable products, from tetraethyl lead in gasoline and PCBs in batteries to asbestos, DDT, and Agent Orange that are now well established as seriously harmful, only withdrawing them, often only from domestic use, under overwhelming legal and regulatory pressure. For the products they have wanted to sell, they have always found scientists who would testify to their harmlessness, or that claims of harm were not scientifically proven. There has been a consistent, sharp difference between the results of industry-sponsored science and those of independent researchers working the same terrain. And there have been numerous cases of fraud in industry testing, industry use of testing labs that arranged the data to find industry products acceptable, and political manipulation to weaken regulatory standards. Despite these industry abuses of science, the media have largely accepted the industry's claim that it supports sound science, in contrast with its critics' use of junk science. From 1996 through September 1998, 258 articles in mainstream newspapers used the phrase junk science, but only 21 or 8% used it to refer to corporate abuses of science, whereas 160 or 62% applied it to science used by environmentalists, other corporate critics, or tort lawyers suing corporations. 77 or 30% didn't fit either of these categories. In short, The media have internalized industry's self-legitimizing usage, just as they have normalized a status quo of caveat emptor, buyer beware, rather than of safety first. The media have also regularly gotten on board in dismissing concerns about chemical threats as unwarranted scares, such as the alleged scares over dioxin and the danger of ALAR on apples. But these and other scares often turn out to be based on genuine health hazards. Meanwhile, the media rarely report and examine in any depth the frequent evidence of the inadequacy of regulation and testing and of the real costs of chemicalization of the environment. For example, the International Joint Commission, IJC, a joint Canadian-U.S. venture dating back to 1978, was given the formidable task of trying to halt the flow of toxic chemicals into the Great Lakes. It reports each year that it is failing, and since 1992 has called for the ending of the manufacture of chlorine as essential to fulfilling its task. The national media virtually ignore this appeal, and the IJC's U.S. co-chairman Gordon Durnill has remarked that, "We have a societal problem about how to deal with this, but 90% of the population doesn't even know there is anything to worry about." We believe that the propaganda model helps understand this lack of knowledge. In the health insurance controversy of 1992-93, the media's refusal to take the single-payer option seriously, despite apparent widespread public support and the effectiveness of the system in Canada, served well the interests of the insurance and medical service complex. The uncritical media reporting and commentary on the alleged urgency of fiscal restraint and a balanced budget in the years 1992-96 fit well the business community's desire to reduce the social budget and weaken regulation. The media's gullibility in accepting the claim of a social security system crisis, which would require policy action some 37 years ahead if certain conservative guesses were true and a number of easy corrections were ruled out, served the interests of conservative ideologues anxious to weaken a highly successful government program and a security industry eager to benefit from the partial or full privatization of Social Security. The applicability of the propaganda model in these and other cases, including the media's handling of the drug wars, seems clear. Concluding note: the propaganda model remains a useful framework for analyzing and understanding the workings of the mainstream media, perhaps even more so than in 1988. As we noted before, the changes in structural conditions that underlie the model, and that we believe strongly and often decisively influence media behavior and performance, have tended to increase the model's salience. We noted in the preface to the first edition and in chapters 2 and 3, in reference to the media's coverage of the wars and elections in Central America in the 1980s, that the media's performance often surpassed expectations of media subservience to government propaganda demands. This was at least equally true of their performance in covering the 1991 war against Iraq and NATO's war against Yugoslavia in 1999, as we have described earlier and briefly in regard to Yugoslavia and in detail elsewhere. In our conclusion to the first edition, we emphasized that as the negative performance effects of the media result primarily from their structure and objectives, real change in performance calls for substantial changes in underlying media organization and goals. In the years since 1988, structural changes have not been favorable to improved performance, but it remains a central truth that democratic politics requires a democratization of information sources and a more democratic media. Along with trying to contain and reverse the growing centralization of the mainstream media, grassroots movements and intermediate groups that represent large numbers of ordinary citizens should put much more energy and money into creating and supporting their own media, as they did with the independent media centers brought into existence during the Seattle and Washington, D.C. protests of 1999 and 2000. These and other nonprofit community-based broadcasting stations and networks, and a better use of public access channels, the Internet, and independent print media will be essential for the achievement of major democratic, social, and political successes. Preface. In this book, we sketch out a propaganda model and apply it to the performance of the mass media of the United States. This effort reflects our belief, based on many years of study on the workings of the media, that they serve to mobilize support for the special interests that dominate the state and private activity, and that their choices, emphases, and omissions can often be understood best, and sometimes with striking clarity and insight, by analyzing them in such terms. Perhaps this is an obvious point, but the democratic postulate is that the media are independent and committed to discovering and reporting the truth, and that they do not merely reflect the world as powerful groups wish it to be perceived. Leaders of the media claim that their news choices rest on unbiased, professional, and objective criteria, and they have support for this contention in the intellectual community. If, however, the powerful are able to fix these premises of discourse, to decide what the general populace is allowed to see, hear, and think about, and to manage public opinion by regular propaganda campaigns, the standard view of how the system works is at serious odds with reality. The special importance of propaganda in what Walter Lippmann referred to as the manufacture of consent has long been recognized by writers on public opinion, propaganda, and the political requirements of social order. Lippmann himself, writing in the early 1920s, claimed that propaganda had already become a regular organ of popular government and was steadily increasing in sophistication and importance. We do not contend that this is all the mass media do, but we believe the propaganda function to be a very important aspect of their overall service. In the first chapter, we spell out a propaganda model, which describes the forces that cause the mass media to play a propaganda role, the processes whereby they mobilize bias, and the patterns of news choices that ensue. In the succeeding chapters, we try to demonstrate the applicability of the propaganda model to the actual performance of the media. Institutional critiques, such as we present in this book, are commonly dismissed by establishment commentators as conspiracy theories, but this is merely an evasion. We do not use any kind of conspiracy hypothesis to explain mass media performance. In fact, our treatment is much closer to a free market analysis, with the results largely an outcome of the workings of market forces. Most biased choices in the media arise from the pre-selection of right-thinking people, internalized preconceptions, and the adaptation of personnel to the constraints of ownership, organization, market, and political power. Censorship is largely self-censorship by reporters and commentators who adjust to the realities of source and media organizational requirements, and by people at higher levels within media organizations who are chosen to implement and have usually internalized the constraints imposed by proprietary and other market and governmental centers of power. There are important actors who do take positive initiatives to define and shape the news and to keep the media in line. It is a guided market system that we describe here, with the guidance provided by the government, the leaders of the corporate community, the top media owners and executives, and the assorted individuals and groups who are assigned or allowed to take constructive initiatives. These initiators are sufficiently small in number to be able to act jointly on occasion, as do sellers in markets with few rivals. In most cases, however, media leaders do similar things because they see the world through the same lenses, are subject to similar constraints and incentives, and thus feature stories or maintain silence together in tacit collective action and leader-follower behavior. The mass media are not a solid monolith on all issues. Where the powerful are in disagreement, there will be a certain diversity of tactical judgment on how to attain generally shared aims, reflected in media debate. But the views that challenge fundamental premises or suggest that the observed modes of exercise of state power are based on systemic factors will be excluded from the mass media, even when elite controversy over tactics rages fiercely. We will study a number of such cases as we proceed, but the pattern is, in fact, pervasive. To select an example that happens to be dominating the news as we write, consider the portrayal of Nicaragua under attack by the United States. In this instance, the divisions of elite opinion is sufficiently great to allow it to be questioned whether sponsorship of a terrorist army is effective in making Nicaragua more democratic and less of a threat to its neighbors. The mass media, however, rarely, if ever, entertain opinion or allow their news columns to present materials suggesting that Nicaragua is more democratic than El Salvador and Guatemala in every non-Orwellian sense of the word, that its government does not murder ordinary citizens on a routine basis, as the governments of El Salvador and Guatemala do, that it has carried out socioeconomic reforms important to the majority that the other two governments somehow cannot attempt, that Nicaragua poses no military threat to its neighbors but has, in fact, been subjected to continuous attacks by the United States and its clients and surrogates, and that the U.S. fear of Nicaragua is based more on its virtues than on its alleged defects. The mass media also steer clear of discussing the background and results of the closely analogous attempt of the United States to bring democracy to Guatemala in 1954 by means of a CIA-sponsored invasion, which terminated Guatemalan democracy for an indefinite period. Although the United States supported elite rule and helped to organize state terror in Guatemala, among many other countries, for decades, actually subverted or approved the subversion of democracy in Brazil, Chile, and the Philippines, again among others, is constructively engaged with terror regimes on a global basis, and had no concern about democracy in Nicaragua as long as the brutal Somoza regime was firmly in power. Nevertheless, the media take government claims of a concern for democracy in Nicaragua at face value. Elite disagreement over tactics in dealing with Nicaragua is reflected in public debate, but the mass media, in conformity with elite priorities, have coalesced in processing news in a way that fails to place U.S. policy into meaningful context, systematically suppresses evidence of U.S. violence and aggression, and puts the Sandinistas in an extremely bad light. In contrast, El Salvador and Guatemala, with far worse records, are presented as struggling toward democracy under moderate leaders, thus meriting sympathetic approval. These practices have not only distorted public perceptions of Central American realities, they have also seriously misrepresented U.S. policy objectives, an essential feature of propaganda, as Jacques Ellul stresses. The propagandist naturally cannot reveal the true intentions of the principal for whom he acts. That would be to submit the projects to public discussion, to the scrutiny of public opinion, and thus to prevent their success. Propaganda must serve instead as a veil for such projects, masking true intention. The power of the government to fix frames of reference and agendas and to exclude inconvenient facts from public inspection is also impressively displayed in the coverage of elections in Central America, discussed in Chapter 3, and throughout the analysis of particular cases in the chapters that follow. When there is little or no elite dissent from a government policy, there may still be some slippage in the mass media, and facts that tend to undermine the government line, if they are properly understood, can be found, usually on the back pages of the newspapers. This is one of the strengths of the U.S. system. It is possible that the volume of inconvenient facts can expand as it did during the Vietnam War in response to the growth of a critical constituency, which included elite elements from 1968. Even in this exceptional case, however, it was very rare for news and commentary to find their way into the mass media if they failed to conform to the framework of established dogma, postulating benevolent U.S. aims, the United States responding to aggression and terror, etc., as we discuss in Chapter 5. During and after the Vietnam War, apologists for state policy commonly pointed to the inconvenient facts, the periodic pessimism of media pundits, and the debates over tactics as showing that the media were adversarial and even lost the war. These allegations are ludicrous, as we show in detail in Chapter 5. But they did have the dual advantage of disguising the actual role of the mass media and, at the same time, pressing the media to keep even more tenaciously to the propaganda assumptions of state policy. We have long argued that the naturalness of these processes, with inconvenient facts allowed sparingly and within the proper framework of assumptions, and fundamental dissent virtually excluded from the mass media, but permitted in a marginalized press, makes for a propaganda system that is far more credible and effective in putting over a patriotic agenda than one with official censorship. In criticizing media priorities and biases, we often draw on the media themselves for at least some of the facts. This affords the opportunity for a classic non sequitur, in which the citations of facts from the mainstream press by a critic of the press is offered as a triumphant proof that the criticism is self-refuting, and that media coverage of disputed issues is indeed adequate. That the media provides some facts about an issue, however, proves absolutely nothing about the adequacy or accuracy of that coverage. the mass media do, in fact, literally suppress a great deal, as we will describe in the chapters that follow. But even more important in this context is the question of the attention given to a fact, its placement, tone, and repetitions, the framework of analysis within which it is presented, and the related facts that accompany it and give it meaning, or preclude understanding. That a careful listener looking for a fact can sometimes find it with diligence and a skeptical eye tells us nothing about whether that fact received the attention and context it deserved, whether it was intelligible to the listener or effectively distorted or suppressed. What level of attention it deserved may be debatable, but there is no merit to the pretense that because certain facts may be found in the media by a diligent and skeptical researcher, the absence of radical bias and de facto suppression is thereby demonstrated. One of our central themes in this book is that the observable pattern of indignant campaigns and suppressions, of shading and emphasis, and of selection of context, premises, and general agenda is highly functional for established power and responsive to the needs of the government and major power groups. A constant focus on victims of communism helps convince the public of enemy evil and sets the stage for intervention, subversion, support for terrorist states, and endless arms race and military conflict, all in a noble cause. At the same time, the devotion of our leaders and media to this narrow set of victims raises public self-esteem and patriotism, as it demonstrates the essential humanity of country and people. The public does not notice the silence on victims in client states, which is as important in supporting state policy as the concentrated focus on enemy victims. It would have been very difficult for the Guatemalan government to murder tens of thousands over the past decade if the U.S. press had provided the kind of coverage they gave to the difficulties of Andrei Sakharov or the murder of Jerzy Popiełuszko in Poland. It would have been impossible to wage a brutal war against South Vietnam and the rest of Indochina, leaving a legacy of misery and destruction that may never be overcome, if the media had not rallied to the cause, portraying murderous aggression as a defense of freedom, and only opening the doors to tactical disagreement when the costs to the interests they represent became too high. The same is true in other cases that we discuss, and too many that we do not. Chapter 1. A Propaganda Model. The mass media serve as a system for communicating messages and symbols to the general populace. It is their function to amuse, entertain, and inform, and to inculcate individuals with the values, beliefs, and codes of behavior that will integrate them into the institutional structures of the larger society. In a world of concentrated wealth and major conflicts of class interest, to fulfill this role requires systematic propaganda. In countries where the levers of power are in the hands of a state bureaucracy, the monopolistic control over the media, often supplemented by official censorship, makes it clear that the media serve the ends of a dominant elite. It is much more difficult to see a propaganda system at work where the media are private and formal censorship is absent. This is especially true where the media actively compete, periodically attack and expose corporate and governmental malfeasance, and aggressively portray themselves as spokesmen for free speech and the general community interest. What is not evident, and remains undiscussed in the media, is the limited nature of such critiques, as well as the huge inequality in command of resources and its effect both on access to a private media system and on its behavior and performance. A propaganda model focuses on this inequality of wealth and power and its multi-level effects on mass media interests and choices. It traces the routes by which money and power are able to filter out the news fit to print, marginalize dissent, and allow the government and dominant private interests to get their messages across to the public. The essential ingredients of our propaganda model, or set of new filters, fall under the following headings. 1. The size, concentrated ownership, owner wealth, and profit orientation of the dominant mass media firms. 2. Advertising as the primary income source of the mass media. 3. The reliance of the media on information provided by government, business, and experts funded and approved by these primary sources and agents of power. 4. FLAC as a means of disciplining the media. And 5. Anti-communism as a national religion and control mechanism. These elements interact with and reinforce one another. The raw material of news must pass through successive filters, leaving only the cleansed residue fit to print. They fix the premises of discourse and interpretation, and the definition of what is newsworthy in the first place, and they explain the basis and operations of what amount to propaganda campaigns. The elite domination of the media and marginalization of dissidents that results from the operation of these filters occurs so naturally that media news people, frequently operating with complete integrity and goodwill, are able to convince themselves that they choose and interpret the news objectively and on the basis of professional news values. Within the limits of the filter constraints, they often are objective. The constraints are so powerful and are built into the system in such a fundamental way that alternative bases of news choices are hardly imaginable. In assessing the newsworthiness of the U.S. government's urgent claims of a shipment of MiGs to Nicaragua on November 5, 1984, the media do not stop to ponder the bias that is inherent in the priority assigned to government-supplied raw material, or the possibility that the government might be manipulating the news, imposing its own agenda, and deliberately diverting attention from other material. It requires a macro, alongside a micro, story-by-story, view of media operations to see the pattern of manipulation and systematic bias. Let us turn now to a more detailed examination of the main constituents of the propaganda model, which will be applied and tested in the chapters that follow. 1.1. Size, ownership, and profit orientation of the mass media. The first filter. In their analysis of the evolution of the media in Great Britain, James Curran and Gene Seaton describe how, in the first half of the 19th century, a radical press emerged that reached a national working-class audience. This alternative press was effective in reinforcing class consciousness. It unified the workers because it fostered an alternative value system and framework for looking at the world, and because it promoted a greater collective confidence by repeatedly emphasizing the potential power of working people to effect social change through the force of combination and organized action. This was deemed a major threat by the ruling elites. One MP asserted that the working-class newspapers inflame passions and awaken their selfishness, contrasting their current condition with what they contend to be their future condition, a condition incompatible with human nature and those immutable laws which Providence has established for the regulation of civil society. The result was an attempt to squelch the working-class media by libel laws and prosecutions, by requiring an expensive security bond as a condition for publication, and by imposing various taxes designed to drive out radical media by raising their costs. These coercive efforts were not effective, and by mid-century, they had been abandoned in favor of the liberal view that the market would enforce responsibility. Curran and Seaton show that the market did successfully accomplish what state intervention failed to do. Following the repeal of the punitive taxes on newspapers between 1853 and 1869, a new daily local press came into existence, but not one new local working-class daily was established through the rest of the 19th century. Curran and Seaton note that, indeed, the eclipse of the national radical press was so total that when the Labor Party developed out of the working-class movement in the first decade of the 20th century, it did not obtain the exclusive backing of a single national daily or Sunday paper. One important reason for this was the rise in scale of newspaper enterprise and the associated increase in capital costs from the mid-19th century onward, which was based on technological improvements along with the owner's increased stress on reaching large audiences. The expansion of the free market was accompanied by an industrialization of the press. The total cost of establishing a national weekly on a profitable basis in 1837 was under £1,000, with a break-even circulation of 6,200 copies. By 1867, the estimated startup cost of a new London daily was £50,000. The Sunday Express, launched in 1918, spent over £2 million before it broke even with a circulation of over 250,000. Similar processes were at work in the United States, where the startup cost of a new paper in New York City in 1851 was $69,000. The public sale of the St. Louis Democrat in 1872 yielded $456,000. and city newspapers were selling at from $6 to $18 million in the 1920s. The cost of machinery alone, of even very small newspapers, has for many decades run into the hundreds of thousands of dollars. In 1945, it could be said that even small newspaper publishing is big business and is no longer a trade one takes up lightly even if he has substantial cash, or takes up at all if he doesn't. Thus, the first filter, the limitation on ownership of media with any substantial outreach by the requisite large size of investment, was applicable a century or more ago, and it has become increasingly effective over time. In 1986, there were some 1,500 daily newspapers, 11,000 magazines, 9,000 radio and 1,500 TV stations, 2,400 book publishers, and 7 movie studios in the United States, over 25,000 media entities in all. But a large portion of those among this set who were news dispensers were very small and local, dependent on the large national companies and wire services for all but local news. Many more were subject to common ownership, sometimes extending through virtually the entire set of media variants. Ben Bagdikian stresses the fact that despite the large media numbers, the 29 largest media systems account for over half of the output of newspapers, and most of the sales and audiences in magazines, broadcasting, books, and movies. He contends that these constitute a new private ministry of information and culture that can set the national agenda. Actually, while suggesting a media autonomy from corporate and government power that we believe to be incompatible with